is tape two of Peter Chance. I'll say it again in case that wasn't on. This is tape two of Peter Chance.
So the next thing that happened was I was told to sit down and take my sock off because I couldn't put a shoe on by this time. So well, and he took another look at it, and in a matter of literally seconds, it seemed, the thick-baked Tiffy was there, the delightful governor of Hodgkin's, who again served with us all the time out there in the Far East. And I was injected three times in rapid succession, and it hurt, and things bucked up very rapidly as it froze. And then, of course, it was all over. He was most adept with the scalpel and all the rest of the things that were necessary, and I was then, my toe was wrapped up rather like an Italian peach in cotton wool, and I was, or rather like an elderly gentleman with the mumps or something of the sort, and told to take it easy, and here's some pills, Darabon, I think is what he gave me, and I got a pair of crutches, and off I went. And
to Korea?
Well, first of all, I went home. No, not, well, I did, but yes, but the first thing is I was sent home. By this time, we've been billeted in the old, the original Army signals officer's house. As one comes down into the dockyard, and the last rise before you drop into the dockyard is a big red brick house on the left, which was an old Army establishment. We moved in there, subsequently a man named Peter May and his wife Marjorie moved in after we did, and they didn't like it any more than we did. It was a dark and dreary place. And the reason why I mention it, because there's another incident that is pertinent when I get out to Korea. Anyway, I joined the ship, and off we went. And I was in a pretty tough shape, but it was okay, and I was damned if I was going to stay. Well, we had an enormous band of brothers in that ship, and they were all very much individualists, like Fred Little, the gunnery officer, Johnny Waters, communications, Don Saxon as the Taz, Bob Craig, our engineer, a fellow named Boyle, who was the ordnance type, Buzz Nixon, who was the electrical two-striper, who's now our deputy minister, and oh my God, Willie Davis was our, Bill Davis was the pusser, and a fellow by the name of Peter Kosh was our XO, and the captain was himself, Jamie Plomer. Well, off we ran with all 256 of us in that ship for a year of it.
You sailed by yourself?
We sailed by ourselves. We went to Hawaii first, and we did workups there, doing bombardments at Hilo, I think the island was called. Forgotten now. From there, I had the most fascinating and terrifying, in a way, mentally experience, because, don't forget, I'm now on my own. I'm the navigator. I'm qualified. I'm doing it, and come hell or high water, you got to find your way. And the nav aids in the Pacific are pretty crude at this time. They still are, I understand, south of the equator. They're not too bad north of it. And we had to find Johnston Island first, which is on the way to a place called Kwajalein, which Johnston is S-T-O-N-E, and Kwajalein is K-W-A-J-A-L-E-I-N, I think. In the something or other group, I forgot where the hell it is now.
You left Hawaii for Johnston Island.
Yeah, which is a little dot out in the middle of nowhere on the way to Kwajalein, which is in the Marshall Group, which is, again, an atoll only. It's sort of a ring of coral with a slot through. Kwajalein is K-W-A-J-A-L-E-I-N.
12 north.
And about 165 degrees west.
West.
Now, I was feeling a bit twitchy on the morning, I'll never forget this, and there's old Fred Little, he was on watch, and he was known as Papa-san when we got out to Japan, having been there for some time.
Who called him that?
Well, all sorts of people, I think, both ashore and afloat. And we had great fun. And he was tire strength, always. And he said, oh, come on, Pontius, don't be nervous. You're going to see it. I tell you, it's right there, 2 degrees on the port bow. And I thought, oh, come on, Fred, don't be crazy. And there I'm staring like hell, and eventually, sure enough, there's this little drop of land. Well, it was supposed to be there anyway, but, you know. So once again, confidence was built up, and it's a mutual growth of confidence amongst us all. And so after Kwajalein, we went to Guam, and then from Guam up to Tokyo, where we spent a day or two, and then to Sasebo, which was our main base in the southwest corner of the islands, and then beyond that, up on patrol in Korea, in the Yellow Sea. During the time that I was there, most of the activity could be divided into two pretty distinct phases. One was the very dreary business, but necessary, of being plane guard to an aircraft carrier. And then there was the very exciting business of working in conjunction with what we call the ROKs, the Republic of Korea troops and guerrillas. And we did a great deal of this. And moreover, because you must understand, the Canadian vessels were the best outfitted from the point of view of high-definition radar. And so we used to give what we call positive control, courses and speeds and directions and so on, to U.S. vessels, other vessels with whom we worked from time to time, almost invariably at night. And of course, there were no lights. And the tides in the upper areas of the Yellow Sea are rather like that of the Bay of Fundy. They have very tall ranges, and there's lots of tidal stream. And great mud flats that appear rather like up in the Bay of Fundy, the top of the Bay of Fundy. And so you've got to be awfully careful. And indeed, on one occasion, I'll never forget, there was an American destroyer with us, and we were heading north from the 38th parallel, which is more or less where we used to. We spent more time there waiting, and we would turn to and get south of the 38th parallel, but our operations in the main were north of it, with the exception of one or two, which I'll mention in a moment. And again, in passing, we would spend about 26 days out of the month on the line, don't forget. It would take us a day and a bit to get back, and we'd spend a day or so down there refueling and replenishing and so on, and then we'd back up onto the line. Anyway, that sort of gave you a pattern. Well, the second and the this big part of our time, as I say, was in support of guerrilla operations and behind the lines. And so, on this one evening, there was an American ship. We were heading. We're going to head up to a place called Tewado, I think it was called. I don't spell it. T-E-W-A-H-D-O. Tewado. Which is not very far away from the entrance to the Yalu River. And the American ship, they were a bit leery about this. Don't forget, charts were Japanese with English words overlaid, or AMS, American Military Survey charts, I think, something like that. Anyway, maps, that is. American Map Surveys, that's right. And so, the admiralty charts of the area were not terribly good. They hadn't been done for a long, long time. And mud flats shift and that sort of thing, a great deal. Well, we don't forget again, our ship has been modified for Korean activities so that we were never allowed to go below 40% fuel remaining because of the top hamper and equilibrium. Well, we had a fair amount of draft at that rate, and so once again, the tide is rising, and there's a big flats ahead of us. And I knew the tide was rising, or at least I thought I knew. And I said, right. And you must understand, the captain of our ship considers himself that he always must hold himself in readiness for stress and strain and action. So therefore, every officer with a specialty was completely responsible for that specialty. So therefore, in my case, I had a strange and unique position where, as I got it here, I brought it with me. This is the night order book, and I wrote the night order book. And I was in command of the ship's movements. I drove. And so that we had a strange situation that if the captain fell, I was to take command, not the first lieutenant. And everybody knew it, and everybody was prepared to go along with it, although as the first lieutenant, if I were he, I would have been pretty unhappy, but there we are.
Well, I know Peter Kosh is pretty easygoing fellow.
Well, he's a gentle man, period. Yeah. And a great, he had a mind like a librarian, very detailed. But again, anyway, for all that, we got along very well, but this is the thing, and I wrote the Flaming Night Orderman, which is...
What's the title, Captain's Night Orderman?
Sure.
I'm reading for the record, it says, Commanding Officer's Night Order Book, and I'll open the page.
You signed it, but I signed it, too. I wrote it.
And it's in your handwriting, and the captain's signature.
Oh, yeah. Of course. And I would clock in with him every night. We had long chats. All night long, sometimes. And so, anyway, I had nothing but respect for Jungle Jim. But it was a rather strange arrangement. But anyway, from my standpoint, I learned an enormous amount about ship handling and being a commanding officer. And I can't thank him enough for that. Mm-hmm. However, the point of our, again, I'm waffling.
No, you're not. This
getting
is all very
up on the trail.
This is all very interesting.
We said, right, 24 knots, and
yeah, you're heading for the mudflats.
She begins to sit down.
Yes.
And so we said, slower down. 15, and she said, okay, there's enough draft below us. The tide's coming up. And the American is saying, hey, Cayuga. Well, we were called Motorola. That was our call sign. Motorola, this is scrub wash clothes or whatever their title was. I believe you're heading into danger. And so I said, again, I don't think so, but and then the captain said, tell them that, what do you say? Tell them that if they're nervous, and if we take the ground, they can go ahead because we draw more than they do. Well, this put the in a perspective, and of course we went and we were perfectly okay, and they followed. And from there on in, it was fascinating because we were able to actually position ships with a great deal of accuracy, as I'm sure you know from your own experience. With it was the old Sperry HDWS, and it was an excellent set.
Yeah.
You could get down to 200 yards worth, and when if you realize that. With the tide falling in particular, you could see the marks on the screen where the water was shimmering, and so that you could get your channel marked. Now,
go to where it doesn't shimmer.
Well, or stay in between or whatever, you see. So here we are, on one occasion, on one night, we had orders to go north. And we went into the entrance to the Yalu River, which had never been done before. I don't think anybody else has.
Is this
they
this
may
one?
Have done. Yeah. And there's a kind of a U-tube shape.
That's
and so off we went, very gently.
Story, yeah.
And I, everything was done from down below. Captain was on the bridge, and he was sort of having a very fascinating look at the night. But the action was down below in the plot. And we plotted as fast as we could take the reports. Plot, report, plot, report, plot, report. And as a result, we got a very, very accurate description of where the ship was moving vis-a-vis the tide and our direction. Fred Little was on his action plot, and everything was controlled between the two of us and our team. We had a very well-trained team of men, excellent guys. And the matter of fact, right now, there's a man by the name of Gardner, who was a real estate man in town, who came up to me one day and said, remember me? And I said, no. He said, well, I was your navigator's yeoman in Cayuga out in Korea. And we fell in one of his arms, and he was a good-looking man and all that. And fine. That night was highly exciting because the, as I say, it's rather like a U-tube. You went up and against, and then you eased over to starboard as the U-shape, and you shipped in the same with canal effect. And I had experience prior in this one. And so we went up north again, we're heading up, and eventually got into position.
I want to get the picture. You're stemming
north. We're stemming the tide.
You went to port, went almost south again, then altered back to starboard to north.
That's right.
Fine.
So we're holding and stemming the tide, and the weapons are pointing green 90, and an island, and some junks, and all the rest of it, which were our target. And ting ting, boom, and off we went. It was flashless, and of course I didn't see anything. I was down below the entire time. But from the bridge, there was no return fire to the ship. It all was going straight up, because, of course, they felt that no ship would ever go up there, because they were being bombed.
Yes.
And so we were not challenged by return fire whatsoever. We then eventually eased our way back, very, very slowly. And as a result, we managed to get out, turn the ship around, and then crash.
You went back stern first?
No, we managed to turn around.
So you went down slowly with the tide.
Yeah, and again, easing back, deploying, very little rudder, didn't take much.
No.
And very gently, and then as soon as you got out, began to open her up. But of course, one thing you've got to be very careful of. First, we're only 5 minutes away from the Antung airfield. And we weren't attacked, but you had to be terribly careful because the phosphorescence up there was absolutely alarming. Like daylight. And so we crept away, and as we got farther and farther south and we gained a bit more nerve, we put on more speed, but eventually we got down to Pyongyang-do, where we used to, where we anchored, you know, off the entrance to the Chinampo.
So you got up the Yellow River, and how many miles up the river?
Oh, it wasn't far.
No.
We were in the estuary.
Yeah, well,
but,
how many miles?
It was close enough for me.
Yeah. 3, 4, 5 miles?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 6 miles? 7 miles?
I don't recall.
No, it's all right. We can check it. But you did a bombardment unobserved. How many rounds did you fire?
I don't know, but it went on for some time.
It did, eh? 10 minutes?
Yeah. I guess all of that.
Yeah.
Because,
rapid broadsides?
Oh, yes. It was flat trajectory stuff.
Yes.
It was only about 4,000 range, 4,000 yards range.
Mm-hmm.
Just straight in. And again, we did that on a couple of other occasions.
Well, we'll...
And finally,
other
is my watch right?
It is. It's 5:45.
I'll make it 21 minutes to. Anyway, that's fine. I can give you a couple more thoughts for what it's worth here.
And then we'll do the other occasions another time?
Yeah.
The other actions?
Oh, yes. Well, we came back, and this was the kind of pattern that we followed. We worked with guerrillas in support of shore bombardments on a couple of occasions, which I'll explain a bit more thoroughly later on, where there's direct support. And there was some... A man by the name of John Fruin was out there, an RN officer.
F-R-E-W-I-N?
F-R-E-W-I-N, that's right. J.B. Fruin. Who, he was a captain in those days, and he had, certainly he felt anyway, from what I could see of him, he had the Nelsonic approach, and he had a great deal of fun with small vessels. He was kind of a senior officer for ROK small vessels, a coordinator, and they did all sorts of fascinating things behind the lines. Whereas our senior ship was HMS Ceylon and HMS Belfast, and Captain Twiss. No, it wasn't Twiss.
That's in the Navy.
Yeah,
business.
And Belfast, of course, was Strawberry Aubrey. Aubrey Sinclair Ford, known as Strawberry Aubrey. Thring. Captain Thring was the captain of Ceylon.
T-H-R-I-N-G.
Terrific guy. Anyway, we had a thing called Operation Sit and Duck. And that is when a destroyer would go in as close to the beach as possible what was called the slot, which was between two lumps of duff. One was an island, I think one was a peninsula of sorts. And again, 29, 30 foot tides. On one occasion, I'll never forget it as long as I live, we were sitting there with the anchor and Bartok in mud and steam up and everybody on the kettles and on the wheels. And I was on the bridge, the fresh air bridge, as you know, and we had what was known as the CCBC, which was the Cayuga Camera and Binocular Club. Every stoker, cook, and God knows who else was staring around, having a lovely time, when suddenly, to our horror, there was an enormous sort of, and then, and we were straddled from shore with mobile weaponry from the shore, and a long way, about 18,000 yards. And our weapons, max, I suspect, was something like 14, and effective around 10.
Yeah.
And so we had the what's called the Massey-Harris 4-inch.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure if it was on this occasion, and I think it was, Admiral Hibbard was out visiting the fleet, and he was on the bridge when this was going on.
He was straight off the Pacific coast.
That's correct. And General Jim was on the bridge with the, and he said, "Open fire!" And so, Fred Fiddle said, "Aye, aye, sir, but we can't reach. Open fire anyway!" So, here we are banging away at Lulu, as it were, and you could see the bricks falling in the mud flats. Miles the hell gone from the target. Well, this is a bit enough. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, it's time to go." And I slip! And so they whacked and let the cable go.
Yeah.
And I did something that I learned, and I practiced it on that occasion. You put your hands up in front of you, and starboard and port. And turn around, and you've still got starboard and port.
Yeah.
And I took her out full astern, and using the wheels, and created all kinds of smoke, and we lost the cutter when I went full ahead on the port wizard. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the only way. We were straddled all the way.
At what speed?
It was fast as we could go. We were pooping over the quarter deck by the time.
You were going 28?
Oh, no, not astern. I suspect we were probably doing 15 or 16.
15 or 16 astern. And yeah. Of course, your bow wave would be coming over the stern.
Well, sure. And everybody cleared aft, you know. My God, we lost the CCBC in a hell of a hurry.
Okay. Yeah.
We also lost our anchor, eh? And so then we had to, and the cutter. And we had to report these, of course. And there was a certain amount of excitement about that, but as the Admiral was well aware of what was going on, everything turned out all right. But it was really quite amusing. And I'm pretty sure that was the occasion when he was with us, but he was with us when we did have this open firing, but generally speaking, that incident occurred just like that. And we eventually got back close through the range of the 6-inch guns, and of course they were having at it. But the object of the exercise of the sitting duck effort was to draw fire in order that we can then call on the Corsairs with their napalm to come in and do their duty.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That was the object there of it.
Did you ever hear if that was achieved that night?
I don't know. It was daytime, broad daylight.
Broad daylight.
Oh, Lord. Yes. Sure, we had aircraft sizzling around. They were all having a whack, but it was so far away. You know,
yes.
Didn't see much. So well, anyhow, there were
playing decoy much like Prince Andrew was down in the Falklands. Prince Charles was down in the Falklands.
Well, there were another couple of occasions, and I think there may be just time. First of all, our captain developed a hell of a tooth, swollen molar kind of thing. And we were miles to hell gone from a toothy. So something had to be done. And this story's been told before, I'm sure, by others, but I don't know. I guess I was closest to the old man because I spent hours with him every day. I didn't keep watch, by the way. I was always on, as it were. So, and of course, I was always on duty from usually about midnight till about 4 in the morning. And one thing or another. Well, there was one funny thing. And this was when he had to go refueling. And there was a ship known as the Empire something or other. I've forgotten her name now. Great big whopper, as far as we were concerned in those days. And she was anchored in the curve of an island that had a dip in the center, two lumps, and a sort of a hollow in the breast, as it were. And the ship lay in the tide, up and down, and the wind blew through the island and across the ship, as it were. In point of fact, the tide was stronger than the wind. But as one came in to come alongside, you tend to drift off, you see. So, it's, as I say, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we've been doing one of these night capers, and we had to refuel. And so, as we got close, I thought, well, I better waken the old man. So I went down, and I said, excuse me, sir, we're getting close to the anchorage. Oh, thank you, Father. And he was always the soul of courtesy, bless his heart. And of course, we had red lights and all that sort of thing. And so, in order to be as bright as possible, as far as our eyes were concerned, with the light, and it was hard to see. And anyway, we got up there, and we came barreling in. Everybody on deck was meant to be, shamooly guns aloft. And we came fairly close, we slowed down, we just about to get alongside, and she started to drift off. Well, we fired the guns, and they dropped in the drink. There's no way. Back her off again. Try once more. This time, with a certain amount of zest, we came in and we overshot. And we went on. And then, okay, and by the way, he said, I'll do this part. I'll bring her alongside, don't forget. And so I'm standing there. I'm the voice bite person this time, which is the standard procedure. Fair enough. Well, the next time we lay back and he said, fine, we're going to do it this time. Because as we made that second pass and we pulled off, there was a shout from the poop of this great tanker saying, hey, skipper, why don't you anchor and we'll come alongside you? God, this inflamed the old man. So he came alongside, all right. Geez, we took the guardrails off. There were sparks and flames and every other bloody thing. We thought we were going to go to Kingdom Come. And so the lashings went over and all the rest of the power. That was that. From the molar situation, Joe Sear removed the old man's infected tooth. He got the right one after great difficulty and said once more, when he was inspecting it for the first time and I was there, he said, well, you know, Captain, he said, we didn't get much dentistry in medical school, but we've got all the books, I've got all the tools, and so we'll have at it tomorrow morning. And in the same routine as he did with my foot, he did with the old man and picked them up. So that, again, created great credibility in our doctor. Hey, boy, he's something else, this guy. He's terrific. Eventually, we had another show down in the Heju Estuary, H-E-J-U Estuary. There's one of these night efforts with a lot of ROKs, and we poured in inflating fire when they went ashore, and they did their thing, and they came back with sacks of rice and cattle and God knows what else, and a couple of other guys, and I don't know what, but they had casualties, eh?
Yeah.
And we had people, DOAs on arrival, we had, DOAs, I should say, and we had people who were very badly racked up, and Joe, parading up and down, rather like the fellow Horatio at the bridge, in his whites, looked every inch the most cool customer going, and with all kinds of firing of the small irons, and we were pouring it in ashore as these people came off. Anyway, he patched up some people, and there was one guy who was very badly, got a big hole in his chest, and then plucked out hunks of metal and so on, and he lived. And so Don Saxon and I, in particular, we were very keen about this, and so was everybody else, but I think Don and I were perhaps the worst. We were so gung-ho for Joe. We said, look, something has to be done to get Joe a medal.
Yes.
And so our PR fellow by the name of Jenkins, who was on board at the time, nice guy, Al Jenkins. He cooked up a message and he sent it off to CP and AP and everybody else, Reuters, and sure enough, the real Dr. Joseph Sear in somewhere or other down in New Brunswick, forgot the name of the place, Edmonton or something, stood up and said, "Hey, that's me. That fellow you got out there is an imposter."
Is well, that how it came out?
Yeah. And we had a message that came to the ship from Naval Headquarters, and I was John Waters, and I showed this to the old man, and he said, from Naval Headquarters, NDS,
DHQ.
NDHQ, yeah. "To Cayuga, captain eyes only, have reason to believe your medical officer is an imposter. Investigate and report." And so he said, "Those bloody idiots, and all they've done it again. Here's Joe, one of the first-rate guys, you correct. Those oak desk captains back there, they haven't a clue what we're doing out here. Yeah. Keep firing, Fred!" Yeah. Boom!
Yeah.
We're in the middle of one of these night efforts, you see. Yeah. And after and Joe was sent for, and he said, "You don't believe me. You don't believe me." He blew up. And he was very upset. Well, the end of it was that he locked himself in his cabin and filled himself full of barbiturates. And despite our protestations prior to say, "Look, we believe in you, Joe, and you're great, and you're doing a great job, and what the hell, eh?" And the finale was that our chummy ship Ceylon came along, and we went alongside or whatever. We transferred doctors. I don't know whether we were alongside one or another, I can't remember. But we transferred Joe to Ceylon, and he was in terrible shape. He didn't kill himself, but he woke up and said, before he left, "I'll never forget this," on deck. He was sad. And he died just the other day, by the way. And he said, "I'm so sorry. I had hoped that we could have got home, then I could have just left." And when we examined his cabin, we found he had all his clerical garbs and he was to be admitted to the monastery of Tenby in South Wales. And as he came in and out of his roles, he moved back into an ecclesiastical role, whether it be in, as a lay brother or a priest or something of the sort. And in retrospect, as many other people have known, Fred W. Damara, he was Dr. Joseph Sear, our doctor, and we thought the world of him. Every mother's son from captain to the junior boy. Just terrific. So we lost him, and we lost a great member of our ship's company, who was a great blender, and he brought a lot of people together under very tense times. He always had a laugh. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, and he didn't like to have his picture taken, because he was very modest, you see. He didn't realize the latter until afterwards. But there we are, and that's a little anecdote about Joseph Sear, who, I might add, came back to attend the Cayuga reunion that took place in Naden a couple of years ago. And he came up from his then job when he was the resident chaplain at the Good Samaritan Hospital in Anaheim, California, the Reverend Fred W. Damara, D.D. Don't ask me.
Yeah.
But that was it. That was it. Lovely.
And so, Peter, as we discussed off the tape, you return to Canada after this adventurous, interesting, rewarding, and history-making commission in Her Majesty's Canadian destroyer, Cayuga. So, on behalf of the historian, I thank you and express the hope that I may come back if your three tapes lead to any further questions. I know how busy you are as the BC representative of the Duke of Edinburgh Awards, and yet you've been generous with your time. You were that way when we were snotties in 1939, and you haven't changed. So, I'll leave the door ajar. I may be back.